Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org, who, after the Senate government shutdown surrender, insists it's clearer now more than ever Democrats must fundamentally overhaul their strategy and tactics. John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of New York's independent newspaper, who reflects on Zoran Mamdani's historic New York City mayoral election victory and the challenges he'll face governing America's largest city. And William I. Robinson, professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who in an excerpt of a recent talk explains the connection between the crisis of global capitalism and rising austerity and repression. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On Election Day, over a million voters elected Zoran Mamdani, a self-proclaimed democratic socialist, mayor of New York City. It was the biggest turnout in a municipal election in New York since 1969, driven by the city's first South Asian Muslim immigrant mayor's promises of free bus fare, universal child care, and freezing the rent for regulated apartments. While the political establishment and corporate media were critical of such pledges, these public services have been the norm in many European cities for decades. More than 10 years ago, Tallinn, Estonia's capital, became the largest city in the world to offer free bus service paid by a residential tax. Free buses are also provided to citizens in several French cities as well as in Luxembourg and Malta. Although Mamdani pledged to make childcare free for all children aged 6 weeks to 5 years in the city, earlier this year, New Mexico was the first U.S. state to implement a free childcare program. Portugal's government began providing free childcare in 2022, and most families in Nordic countries receive generous subsidies to pay for childcare. Mamdani's proposal to freeze the rent for 1 million New Yorkers is considered controversial by many politicians and media outlets. But the city's Rent Guidelines Board supported a rent freeze 4 times over the past 10 years during Bill de Blasio's tenure as mayor. Thomson Reuters, a Canadian-based multinational company whose data collection products are being used by U.S. government agencies, including ICE and Donald Trump's mass deportation campaign, have raised serious questions about surveillance, due process, and the rights of migrants and asylum seekers. Thomson Reuters tools have been used to gather information that identifies the possible location of ICE targets, such as addresses, phone numbers, and employers, as well as information on immigrant rights activists, making them targets for harassment and retaliation. Canada's British Columbia General Employees Union, representing more than 95,000 members in the public and private sectors, is a long-term investor in Thomson Reuters. The union is pressuring the Toronto-based data broker to adopt international human rights standards and to be transparent about the risks its artificial intelligence tools may pose to the public. Similar investment campaigns are being organized at Meta, Microsoft, and Google's parent company, Alphabet, while the AFL-CIO has pressured the entertainment industry to adopt AI principles to counter the dehumanization of the U.S. workforce. With the Trump regime weakening federal AI regulations, Kit Walsh of the Electronic Frontier Foundation says that shareholder proposals are one of the tools to create some accountability where there isn't enough. In late October, the government of South Africa announced a new energy policy with a goal of cutting the nation's dependence on coal and ending rolling blackouts, both of which have hampered economic growth for more than a decade. The plan would see South Africa invest around $127 billion in energy infrastructure by 2039, targeted to expanding energy from nuclear power and natural gas, while increasing energy generated by wind from 8 to 24% and solar from 10 to 18%. However, the plan doesn't abandon the burning of coal, the biggest contributor of greenhouse gas emissions and pollution. Rather, it proposes using so-called clean coal technology that critics argue is expensive, ineffective, and unreliable. South Africa's decision not to phase out coal follows a global trend in which green energy adoption has slowed since Donald Trump took office in January. During Trump's second term, the U.S. has canceled $56 million in grants and $1 billion in commercial loans to aid South Africa's transition away from coal. Without U.S. assistance, it's unclear how South Africa will attract the investments that it needs to push through its energy transition. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Just days after Democratic candidates celebrated coast-to-coast election victories, including governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey, eight U.S. senators caucusing with the Democrats broke ranks and voted with Republicans to reopen the government after a record 40-day federal shutdown. The legislation they voted for authorizes government funding through the end of January next year, reverses Trump's post-shutdown firing of thousands of federal workers, guarantees retroactive pay for furloughed government workers, and prevents further layoffs through January. But most importantly, the compromise bill did not resolve the demand to extend Affordable Care Act subsidies that trigger the shutdown, which, if not addressed, will more than double monthly health insurance premiums for some 22 million Americans starting in January 2026. A year after the Democratic Party's loss to Donald Trump and Republicans in the 2024 election, many Americans have little confidence in the Democratic Party leadership's ability to mount effective opposition to an authoritarian, corrupt, and erratic president. This despite the fact that Trump has hit his lowest approval rating since the week after he incited the January 6, 2021 Capitol insurrection to overturn his 2020 election loss. Many Democrats condemn the eight senators who bolted the party to vote with Republicans, with several senators calling for Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer to be removed from his leadership position. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and author, who, after the Senate government shutdown surrender, insists it's clearer now more than ever that Democrats must fundamentally overhaul their strategy and tactics.
There's going to be enormous suffering and a lot of deaths that could have been avoided, a lot of illnesses that could have been prevented if there had been a willingness of Democrats to really hold the line, to show not just with rhetoric but with behavior in Congress that health care is crucial, that they're willing to fight for health care as some kind of human right. So the consequences for human beings will be enormous. And the consequences politically, I think we have not begun to see the ripple effects. There's so much justified outrage towards those six Democratic senators or those who caucus with the Democrats in the U.S. Senate, and also Chuck Schumer, the minority leader who, with a wink and a nod, has really facilitated this cave-in to the accommodation toward the MAGA forces, toward really Donald Trump. So we don't know how this will play out, but ironically, it could strengthen the momentum of progressive forces. This atrocious event, the cave-in of these Democratic or Democratic caucusing senators, this will have enormous effects, I think, to energize people around the country to realize that we can't just go along to get along with Democrats just because they have a D after their name and they're not as terrible as Republicans. And I think, in short, there'll be a lot of primarying, primary as a verb, of incumbent Democrats who should be challenged from the left.
Thanks, Norman. In your commentary, and again, I'll read the title of it, A Year After Trump Won, Why Won't Democrats Change Their Playbook? You point out that year after year, the Democrats fail to address the nation's growing inequality by delivering substantive policies to improve working Americans' lives. Where the Democrats embrace Wall Street and middle-of-the-road incremental policy changes, Trump comes along in 2016 and again in 2024 and promises to disrupt and blow up the entire system, while, of course, not delivering any policies that help working American families. But instead, he guts social safety net programs for workers to give his millionaire and billionaire buddies the largest tax break in U.S. history. We have two major parties that aren't really addressing the core issues for the majority of American people and working families. The system is failing. Now, you talk optimistically about new leadership for the Democratic Party that can maybe stop this kind of yo-yo or ping-pong politics where voters are forced to dump one party, go to the other party, they fail them, they go back to the other. It's almost comical to see it if it wasn't so tragic.
Well, it is very, very tragic, and this has been a pattern that's spiraling downward, unfortunately. We have the worst administration in any of our lifetimes, in control of the executive branch, in control of the legislative branch, and largely, as well, the judicial branch. And I think we can trace a lot of it to a point that Senator Bernie Sanders made to a reporter back in 2017. Bernie Sanders said, and I'm quoting here, "Certainly there are some people in the Democratic Party who want to maintain the status quo. They would rather go down with the Titanic so long as they have first-class seats." And the staterooms that people like Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader of the House, or Chuck Schumer, the minority leader of the Senate, they're comfortable, they have power, they're running the show for Democrats on Capitol Hill, but we're suffering. And they have an accommodationist attitude that is corrosive because it keeps moving the frame of reference, the Overton window, rightward instead of taking a stand and insisting that health care is a human right, education is a human right, so is environmental protection and not living in a poisoned environment. We really have a dug-in so-called leadership of the Democratic Party. My belief, and at Roots Action, we have this belief in terms of our organizing at rootsaction.org, that we have to put up a fight, that yes, we need to critique the Democratic Party, yes, we need to be very clear about what's wrong with the so-called leadership, but we need to challenge them concretely, not only with articles and books and broadcasts and so forth, as important as that is, but also primary challenges, really go up against the so-called leadership that is being provided, that is really accommodating to the MAGA forces.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org, whose forthcoming book is titled The Blue Road to Trump Hell. Find a link to his recent commentary, A Year After Trump Won, Why Won't Democrats Change Their Playbook, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Zohran Mamdani's election victory November 4th, becoming New York City's first Muslim, South Asian, immigrant, democratic socialist, and youngest mayor in a century, is by most measures historic. Mamdani, a state assemblyman from Queens, was polling at 1% when he launched his campaign in October last year. But he gained wide support by a singular focus on the issue of affordability, pledging to freeze the rent for all stabilized apartments, provide free and fast bus service, city-run grocery stores, and universal child care, paid for by increased taxes on the city's wealthiest residents. The 34-year-old candidate beat the well-funded independent campaign of former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and a steady stream of Islamophobic smears by running a brilliant social media campaign and never backing away from his identity as an outsider, challenging a system that for decades has failed to deliver positive change for the city's 8 million residents. Essential to his victory was the field operation run by the New York chapter of Democratic Socialists of America that recruited an army of more than 100,000 volunteers who, during the campaign, knocked on over 3 million doors across the city. Your reporter spoke with John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent, New York City's free progressive monthly newspaper, who reflects on Zoran Mamdani's historic election victory, the challenges ahead for governing America's largest city, and how his winning campaign could impact national politics.
Zoran's a tremendously energetic politician, and on Tuesday he was elected with more than 1 million votes, the most in more than 50 years here in New York City, while running, as you said, explicitly as a Democratic Socialist. And his campaign was the largest electoral campaign waged by the left in the United States since Bernie's two presidential runs. And, by becoming the mayor-elect of a city of more than 8 million people with its outsized cultural and media influence, Zoran's victory is probably the greatest electoral victory in the history of the American left. As far as why Zoran was so successful, I mean, the corporate media likes to highlight his social media skills, and he's got a great smile, and he's a charismatic speaker and very energetic, and that's all true. But I think it's more than the style, there's the substance. I mean, one, he directly connected with people's concerns and frustrations with the high cost of living and proposed concrete solutions for how to address that. And all of that was very appealing. And then the other thing he did is he really embraced the cosmopolitanism of the city. He's an immigrant himself. He came here when he was 7. And he just showed tremendous love for the city and all the diversity of its people.
John, as you just said, Mamdani focused like a laser beam on the issue of affordability. That resonated with voters. Obviously, he won. But what are the many obstacles standing in the way of Mamdani's agenda of providing free bus transportation, universal child care, a rent freeze, and these city-run grocery stores? Certainly, New York Governor Kathy Hochul up in Albany and the legislature will have a lot to do with what happens in New York, as well as Trump, who's threatened to cut off federal funding to New York City, calling Mamdani a dangerous communist. There are a lot of obstacles there, but how do you think he'll meet that challenge?
Yes, it's going to be a challenge. With the rent freeze he proposed, mayors appoint something here in New York called a rent guidelines board, and then the guidelines board decides how much the rents on those million apartments go up each year. Zoran has made it clear what kind of board he would appoint. It's possible that Eric Adams, the Elgoy mayor, may gum that up with some last-minute appointments. But in time, Zoran will gain control of that rent guidelines board, and I assume he would follow through on his promise with that. With some of these other items, they will require higher taxes on the rich. That's been the proposal from the beginning. New York has a lot of billionaires and multimillionaires who benefit tremendously from being here. And for all their threats to leave, they never do. And our governor, Kathy Hochul, has been very protective of her super rich constituents who donate very generously to her political campaigns. But the thing is, she's up for re-election next year. She's facing a challenge from the left, from her current lieutenant governor. And then she'll have to run in the fall if she wins the primary against a Republican, Elise Stefanik. So she wants to make sure she wins the primary and then that she can mobilize support from here in New York City when she has to go up for election in the fall. She's from Buffalo and has never been much enthusiasm for here in New York City. So she, by September, had kind of hitched her wagon to Zoran. She saw the movement behind him and wanted to try to glom on to that. And it's going to be a dance. Here in New York, the governor and the state legislature, by law, are supposed to hammer out the annual state budget by April 1st of each year. That budget is roughly $250 billion of taxes and expenditures. You know, so Zoran is calling for $10 billion in new taxes on the super rich and on large profitable corporations. And that would fund his universal child care initiative, the fast and free buses. You know, is he going to get all of it? I'm not sure. But the interesting thing is New York City DSA and other allied community and civic groups on the left here are preparing to wage an enormous public mobilization campaign early next year as that state budget moves through the legislature to try to prevail upon the governor and all the state legislators who are all up for reelection next year to get on board with as much of Zoran's agenda as possible. So we'll see. Hochul said, oh, you can't pressure me. Well, I'd say that's her opening bid. I think she'll have to come to the table. She's indicated she wants to do something on the child care in particular, which would be a huge win for both her and Zoran if they get it done.
That was John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent, New York City's free progressive monthly newspaper. Find links to The Independent and other media coverage of Mamdani's election campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Connecticut Civil Liberties Defense Committee, a coalition of unions, rank-and-file workers, faith leaders, and community members formed in April, held a day-long conference in Hartford on November 8th, titled Our Power, a Working People's Conference on Civil Liberties and Resistance. Conference workshops were led by local and national activists to discuss issues including building an intersectional movement against police brutality, defending due process and immigrant rights, and protecting academic freedom and the Palestine Solidarity Movement. The event's keynote speaker was William I. Robinson, professor of sociology and global and international studies, Latin American and Iberian studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Robinson is an authority on what's driving the world's elites toward ever greater austerity and repression. His talk focused on the political economic context in which neoliberal governments are losing authority and the far right is gaining ground, as well as the relationship between the crisis of global capitalism and strategies needed to resist. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the conference and presents this excerpt of Robinson's talk.
But then this globalization boom comes to an end with the global financial collapse of 2008. And the transnational capitalist class, what happens here? They accumulate up until 2008, and since then, even more. They accumulate more money than they can spend, much less reinvest. This is what we call technically surplus capital. These vast quantities of capital that have nowhere to go. And the thing is, that means it's idle capital. And capital has to continue to accumulate. It cannot be idle. If there is capital is idle, that is a state of crisis. And it brings us all down with it. Capital has to expand. It's like riding a bicycle. You stop pedaling the bicycle, it slows down, and it falls over. Capitalism stops expanding outward. It stops conquering new territories and new peoples and new markets and seizing new resources. It goes into crisis. And we are in the precipice of another giant crisis, something which may go beyond the financial collapse of 2008. And for me, it's not a question of if that crisis will take place, it's when. And it may be a lot sooner than we think. So the great challenge that the ruling classes face right now is how to expand, how to continue accumulating capital, how to unload this enormous surplus profits that it's just sitting on, how to continue making profits. And so they've been pursuing, especially since 2008, but before also, three ways of continuing to expand and make profit and keep the global economy going that are unsustainable. One is debt. Debt is at an all-time high. It's at $300 trillion worldwide, whereas the whole global economy is only worth $100 trillion. And consumer debt, we're maxed out, not just here in the United States, worldwide. Working class can't assume any more debt. And then there's state debt. The state has been going into all of this debt, but not for us, not to help us workers. And then there is all of this speculation. It boggles the mind, the levels of speculation, and that's producing multiple bubbles. One bubble is cryptocurrency. That's nothing but a speculative instrument. It has nothing to do with real wealth and real people like us. But the biggest bubble right now is artificial intelligence, and it's going to bust, and that might be the trigger to bring about this next crisis and collapse. So these outlets to continue having the global economy move forward at a time of profound overaccumulation and stagnation, they're becoming exhausted. They're not doing the trick anymore. So the transnational capitalist class is in this desperate search for outlets to unload surplus capital. That means it is seeking to, and doing it, violently cracking open new spaces for global accumulation all around the world, in the United States and all around the world. And so right now, the ruling classes, the capitalist states that are the instruments of the transnational capitalist class, they're engaged in this vast, digitally driven restructuring and transformation of global capitalism. We're seeing right now this worldwide round of predatory expansion, of extractivist seizure of resources, the expansion of wars and conflicts, displacement of millions, and repression. This is what's taking place behind the headlines, this imminent war with Venezuela, the war against immigrants and ICE terrorism, and so forth. And above all, what these ruling classes and the transnational capitalist class here, but also I'm speaking about the whole world, what they're seeking to do now is to transfer the costs of the crisis onto the working and popular classes. And we need to be clear about this, that global Trumpisms is an all-out attack on the working classes as capitalist states assume authoritarian, dictatorial, and fascist forms. As instruments, these capitalist states assuming those forms as instruments for capitalist class warfare. They are seeking, as we know very well, to smash whatever remains of the regulatory state, to smash and eliminate whatever remains of the social welfare state, total privatization, the pulverization of wages, the repression of unions, the containment and really the extermination of surplus humanity, to lock us all into permanent precarity and vulnerability, and also to counter stagnation, and also to counter the actual rebellion underway amongst us, the masses of people in the world, but also the potential rebellion. They are deepening what I call militarized accumulation and accumulation by repression, meaning that repression and wars and so forth are a way of making profit and getting out of stagnation in and of themselves, and they are also an instrument for smashing resistance to this system. So we're seeing the rapid militarization of the whole economy and society and the expansion of what I refer to as the global police state.
That was William I. Robinson, professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His recent books include Epochal Crisis, The Exhaustion of Global Capitalism, and The Global Police State. Learn more about the Conference on Civil Liberties and Resistance and the featured speakers by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WEFR in Fairmont, West Virginia, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, KMRE in Bellingham, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.